This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Struck him in his back, ricocheted throughout his chest, and he lasted 30 minutes after that, and the doctor said they didn't know how he did, but he was determined to live. The good thing, his body's not here, but he still lives. And I'm very happy, proud, and pleased to have played a part in making that come true.
Merle Evers, 50 years ago today, June 12, 1963. Her husband, the civil rights leader Medgar Evers, 37 years old, was assassinated in his driveway in Jackson, Mississippi. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felsar and Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzdra, Amy Littlefield, Martinez, DeRose, Denima Allen. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Hugh Grand, Jessica Lee. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and our new frequency, 104.3 FM, Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 5 o'clock straight up. It's time for the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland appearance of David K. Johnston, author of the book, The Rise of Monopolists: Why the Few Get Rich While Your Paycheck Shrinks. The book explains how the already very rich have for three decades quietly earned huge profits with help from politicians. David K. Johnston will be speaking at the First Unitarian Church on Friday, June 14th at 7 p.m. about the devastating economic stories unfolding in the public record that major media do not cover. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to Creative Collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food, and a beer garden, all organized by Creative Collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy as well. Hump Day PDX is June 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. and every second Wednesday of the month thereafter at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Department of Housing and Urban Development released a study showing pervasive racial discrimination in housing.
An Oregon natural gas company filed an application to build a natural gas terminal near the mouth of the Columbia River.
And the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives voted to outlaw abortions after 20 weeks, putting the bill to the House floor for a vote next week.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 12, 2013. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Oregon LNG, based in Warrenton, filed a formal application on Friday with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to build a liquefied natural gas import-export terminal near the mouth of the Columbia River. This filing follows a similar application filed last month for an LNG terminal in Coos Bay. Both projects would liquefy gas obtained by the controversial extraction process called fracking, piped from around the United States. LNG terminals and the pipelines feeding them have aroused opposition from environmentalists, local residents where the terminals are proposed, and landowners along the pipeline routes. The Warrenton project would include a pipeline running through Clatsop, Tillamook, and Columbia counties and under the Columbia River to connect with another pipeline from Washington State near Woodland, Washington. Backers of the proposed Warrenton terminal say that approval would override opposition from Clatsop County to a gas pipeline for the facility, which would pass through its jurisdiction. The Clatsop Board of Commissioners had made a preliminary decision 2 years ago to withdraw land use approval for the pipeline before it was taken to court by the company. In March of this year, the Oregon Supreme Court declined to review a Court of Appeals decision upholding the county board's action. The commissioners are expected to make a final decision on the pipeline in the coming months. KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke with Clatsop County Public Information Officer Tom Bennett earlier today.
At this point, the county is still proceeding on the assumption that our local land use approval is required as part of the overall approval process for the pipeline component of this project. We haven't gotten input from our legal counsel yet as to how this filing might affect that. So at this point, we're still proceeding with completing the decision on the Oregon pipeline application.
I know the Clatsop County Commission decided against, denied the land use permit for the pipeline, I believe was the issue.
And could
you just discuss that?
There are two separate. The terminal itself is within the city of Warrenton and is solely in their jurisdiction. The application for the 41 miles or so of pipeline came before Clatsop County, and in March of 2011, the Board of Commissioners gave preliminary approval to some findings that denied the land use application from Oregon Pipeline LLC to build the pipeline. Before the board could make a final ruling, that decision was appealed by the company, and it's been going through the appeals process for close to the last 2 years. It's only when this Oregon Supreme Court denied to review the decision by the Court of Appeals to uphold the county's decision that opened the way for the county to take final action.
Now, in an Oregon Live article, it said that Oregon LG claims that approval would preempt opposition from Clatsop County. I know you haven't, you know, discussed this thoroughly with the legal counsel, but do you have any reaction to that statement?
Well, like I said, we're just going to, until we hear otherwise, we're proceeding with the assumption that our review and approval or denial of land use application from the company is relevant. So that's what we're moving on now.
Do you have any idea how and where these issues might eventually be sorted out?
You know, I'm not sure if that's going to be in court or at FERC or where. I'm sure we'll find out eventually.
You have a commission's order from July of 2012 that is relevant to that. Would you like to read that for us, please?
Conflicts over jurisdiction between local or state authorities and the federal government over gas fracking, pipelines, LNG terminals, and other extractive industry projects are intensifying around the country. The state of Oregon earlier faced off with federal authorities over the proposed Bradwood Landing LNG terminal on the Columbia River. The state criticized the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, at the time for approving the project with insufficient analysis and before the state had given the necessary permits. Proponents finally abandoned that project after spending over $100 million on permitting efforts. Rowland also spoke this afternoon with Tamara Young Allen of FERC about the commission's current stance on the jurisdictional disputes between the state and federal governments.
In not commenting on the current case, in a previous matter, in an order issued July 12th, in a case involving Millennium Pipeline's mini-sink compressor station in New York, the commission stated in its order, quote, any state or local permits issued with respect to the jurisdictional facilities authorized herein must be consistent with the conditions of this certificate. We encourage cooperation between interstate pipelines and local authorities. However, this does not mean that state and local agencies, through application of state or local laws, may prohibit or unreasonably delay the construction and operation of facilities approved by this commission. In a court case recently, the court held that the Natural Gas Act preempted a Providence, Rhode Island zoning ordinance and enjoined Providence officials from interfering with the facility modification or operation approved by the commission. End quote. The court observed that, quote, because the federal regulatory scheme comprehensively regulates the location, construction, and modification of natural gas facilities, there is no room for local zoning or building code regulations on the same subjects. In short, Congress clearly has manifested an intent to occupy the field and has preempted local zoning ordinances and building codes to the extent that they purport to regulate matters addressed by federal law, end quote.
And so you say this commission order from 2012 that is currently being litigated as well?
Yes, it's currently pending before a U.S. Court of Appeal.
That was Paul Rowland speaking with Tamara Young Allen.
Last night, the city of Beaverton heard public comments regarding a proposed resolution for the city's formal opposition to coal export trains. KBOO's Jemai Cherry reports.
Though Beaverton's no stranger to rail traffic, last night, the issue of rail traffic outside of the city limits was a hot item for discussion.
I don't want to see this natural beauty and wonder spoiled by trains and barges exporting pollution-causing coal. So I'd like to encourage you to pass Agenda Bill 13125 and send a bold message that Beaverton cares not only for the city, but also to make this the best community, too. Thank you.
That was Richard Creeley, a Beaverton resident who is one of many who spoke in a work session before the city council last night. Like Richard, many of the other speakers focused on concerns such as noise, health effects, environmental threats, and the economic impact and ripple effects like delayed access for emergency vehicles that rail traffic may cause. The mayor and city council is expected to sign a resolution to officially oppose coal rail transport at next week's meeting on the 18th, joining the likes of the cities of Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver. Though Beaverton has a railroad, it's not directly in the prospected path of the coal transport trains. Which may beg the question, if no coal will be transported directly through Beaverton, how is this a Beaverton issue? Bonnie McGuig speaks in regards to the issue's relevance to Beaverton.
I distributed flyers this past Saturday at the Beaverton Farmers Market. One of the people asked why coal export is a Beaverton issue. Are there any coal trains planned for our town? I answered that no coal was to be transported through Beaverton, but that it is indeed a Beaverton issue. Standing among flowering hanging baskets and bags of fresh local produce, I answered that even though coal will not directly roll through this community, our state and precious waterways would become a carbon corridor. What will that do to Oregon's green, sustainable reputation? The economic and agricultural impacts of coal will affect all Oregonians. The harmful realities that accompany the transportation of coal will threaten our cultural and historical sites and scenic areas such as the Columbia River Gorge. Of course, what will directly affect the people of Beaverton and the people of the entire planet is the rise of carbon in our shared atmosphere, which has now reached the alarming 400 parts per million level. The coal may be delivered to faraway Asia, but the people and all life forms on this special planet live in the same atmospheric neighborhood. I urge the Beaverton City Council to endorse a resolution in opposition to coal export. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Beaverton's actions are perhaps a reflection of greater regional and global concerns and no doubt in part focused on the possible ripple effects that coal export can have on its burgeoning reputation as a green community. This is Jemai Cherry with KBOO News.
The people of Iran are preparing for elections tomorrow in the midst of a widespread ban on international media. Locally, the 18th Avenue Peace House in Northeast Portland is hosting Iranian analyst Moji Agha tomorrow evening. Agha is on a tour to mark the 60th anniversary of the overthrow of Prime Minister Mossadegh of Iran. The tour seeks to explain new details of the CIA's successful covert operations in Iran in 1952 and 53 that brought about the end of Dr. Mossadegh's dream for a democratic Iran free of British domination. The U.S. and British-led coup put the Shah in power and reimposed British control over Iran's oil resources for decades. KABU's Jennifer Kemp spoke with Moji Agha in our studio here in Portland earlier today.
What is the Mossadegh Legacy Institute?
Well, Mossadegh Legacy Institute is a nonprofit, nonviolent, we the people organization in order to begin introducing Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh to we the people in America. Dr. Mossadegh was Iran's democratically elected, pluralistic prime minister. He's called the Gandhi of Iran, by the way, whose government was cut short after two short years by the coup in 1953 done by the CIA and replacing it with a servile dictatorship. Hence the tour that I'm here for the tomorrow in Portland. The tour is called Mossadegh Awareness Begets Sanity in Foreign Policy. It is being held at Matania or 18th Avenue Peace House. It is at 2116 Northeast 18th Avenue in Portland. And there is a dinner that they have planned for 6 p.m., 6 to 7, and then the program is 7 to 9.
Let's talk about the work of Mohammad Mossadegh. As Prime Minister of Iran in the early 1950s, he implemented a number of social reforms. What were these reforms, and what were their impact on the Iranian people?
He nationalized Iran's oil and petroleum industry. He said, this is our oil, not BP's. The company now that we now know as British Petroleum, said, you know, this is our oil and we're going to extract it and give you pennies. Mossadegh said, no, this is a sovereign country and we don't want to be a colony. And he began a number of reforms, among which was the beginning of workers' compensation, beginnings of many of the things that in this country were initiated by FDR. What Mossadegh said, he said, we want to be free of internal despotism and external colonialism. And he said internal despotism or dictatorship and external colonialism, empire, are two sides of the same coin. They are interdependent. They need each other. And Mossadegh was overthrown because he pointed that maxim out. He said, repression or dictatorship and aggression exercised by the empire are interrelated. They need each other.
Let's talk about what the long-term impacts were of the 1953 coup. How did that affect Iran immediately after and in the decades that followed?
Well, immediately there was a brutal dictatorship for 25 years. It steered Iran into essentially the American sphere of influence, continued exploitive policies, political policies that were dictated onto the dictatorial regime of the Shah. There was repression, there was SAVAK, the secret police, brutal suppression of any kind of democratic freedom, which eventually resulted in a revolution which took Islamic form because the mosque was the only place left that people could congregate safely. But more importantly, with that revolution, people in the region said, we can't use our sense of self-identity as a nation state, to get liberated from the clutches of colonialism. Therefore, we should use religion. And when you use religion for liberation, you may go too far. So we see the development of many manifestations of what is called Islamic radicalism. So these are some of the implications of the overthrow of Dr. Mossadegh.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me.
Thank you.
This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
At this morning's City Council meeting in Portland, the Council approved a plan for a 4-year Equal Employment Opportunity Affirmative Action Plan. The city has long supported affirmative action as a way to address historic inequalities and to provide the opportunity for full and equal participation of women and minorities. But inequalities continue to exist in most city agencies. Anna Conwit of the Portland Bureau of Human Resources spoke at this morning's City Council meeting about the plan.
Once this is approved, then the tracking begins. I will be tracking these baseline strategies every 6 months. You will receive a report, the director will receive a report, and whomever that director wants us to work with to gather this information in regards to their bureaus, they'll be receiving a report. We'll also be working with outreach, employment, diversity resources, senior analysts who do the recruitments for the city of Portland. What they'll be able to do, they'll be able to identify what positions had opened up, and particularly if they're underutilized, you'll be able to see where they did the outreach. You'll be able to see the number of minorities and women and disabled and veterans that were actually on the list. And you'll also be able to see if any of those classes, if they were hired for that position.
That was Anna Conwit of the Portland Bureau of Human Resources speaking at this morning's City Council meeting.
After a relatively smooth 6 months in office, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is facing criticism on three fronts. Hales has come under attack for his lack of transparency in the investigation of chief administrative officer, his mishandling of inappropriate comments made by an aide, and his shrugging off of an agreement with the FBI. An outside investigation of Chief Administrative Officer Jack Graham found that he diverted $200,000 of water and sewer ratepayer money into Portland's general fund. Graham was apparently trying to shield his department from budget cuts last year. Graham has yet to be disciplined for his actions, and Hales has not released the report by the outside investigation and has refused interview requests on this subject. Portland's auditor and others have publicly asked for the report and have criticized Hales. Last Thursday, one of Hales' policy directors, Baruti Arthathri, made inappropriate public comments towards Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith. Hales failed to apologize immediately to Smith and waited until Tuesday to launch an investigation by the Bureau of Human Resources. On Friday, U.S. Attorney Amanda Marshall attacked Hales for not following through with regular meetings among top officials, as agreed with the Joint Terrorism Task Force in 2011. What effect these three missteps will have on Hales' administration remains to be seen.
An effort led by Oregon's two senators to declassify key documents on the government spying program may be dead on arrival, according to Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois. Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden of Oregon, along with six other bipartisan senators, introduced a bill yesterday that would declassify rulings made by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Wyden serves as the Senate Intelligence Committee and knows about the phone and internet data collection programs, but cannot publicly voice all of his concerns. Repeated efforts by Wyden and other senators to expose levels of secrecy have also failed to win majorities in the House and Senate. President Obama defended the widespread surveillance programs as necessary to stop terrorist attacks, saying that they appropriately balance public safety and privacy rights. Senator Durbin says that even if the bill manages to pass in Congress, he doubts that it will make it past the president's desk. Durbin also mentioned that a possible compromise might be struck to allow more members outside of the House and Senate intelligence committees to view classified documents, but Congress members still would not be able to publicly discuss the secret information.
Republicans in the Oregon Senate failed in an effort to sweeten the deal made with apparel giant Nike today. An amendment to House Bill 2059 would have removed the requirement that Nike create 500 jobs and engage in some local investment over the next 10 years. These requirements were negotiated late last year as a way to offer more homegrown businesses comparable consideration to Nike when Nike was given large tax breaks in a special session of the Oregon legislature. The amendment failed on a party-line vote of 16-14, with Democratic Senator Ginny Burdick describing the attempt by Republicans as tantamount to buying a baby a tuxedo. The bill heads to the House for amendment approvals before it heads to the governor's desk to become a law.
Oregon State University has decided to end cooperative housing for more than 200 students at the end of the 2013-2014 school year. Students who have already signed co-op contracts for that year have until July 1st to cancel without penalty and must find new housing by fall of 2014. According to the university, they will close the four rooming houses due to lack of funding for needed renovations. A work group has reportedly been formed to study ways to continue the program using other buildings. There are no current plans for how the university will use the four soon-to-be-closed rooming lodges.
Today marks the 126th day of an ongoing hunger strike by prisoners at Guantanamo Bay Prison Camp. 103 of the 166 prisoners at Guantanamo are currently on strike. 41 are being force-fed with feeding tubes in direct violation of international law. 2 weeks ago, President Obama gave a speech pledging to close Guantanamo and to transfer the remaining prisoners, but no action has been taken to that effect, and the hunger strike continues unabated. Local Solidarity hunger striker and longtime peace activist Brian Wilson had to call off his hunger strike after he was hit by a car while on his hand cycle. He spoke to KABU about that decision.
I was struck by a car at an intersection, an SUV. That was quite a jolt. I was, my cycle was pretty well, it wasn't completely destroyed, but it's about $2,500 worth of damage. And I had physical injuries, but nothing broken, no broken bones. But it actually triggered a series of PTSD reactions for me and panic attacks, which, it doesn't take much once you have PTSD to get provoked with another stressor, and this certainly was a stressor which made it much more difficult to continue fasting.
Brian Wilson is no stranger to sacrificing himself for a cause. After serving in Vietnam, he joined the peace movement, and in 1987 lost his legs when he was run over by a train carrying a nuclear missile during an anti-nuclear protest. He said that he was compelled to action when he heard about the force-feeding of detainees at Guantanamo.
Once you've had war experiences and then you've actually even been injured in the peace movement before for standing up for what you believe, it's part of one's integrity and sense of well-being is always needs to be preserved. And to me, I just couldn't let the Guantanamo situation continue without people knowing about it. I mean, most people still don't know about it. My doctor doesn't know much about it. My different people in my prosthetist I work with, because I'm a double amputee, and he doesn't know. He didn't know anything about it. So that's why I was on a hunger strike. In Vietnam, they were saying that all the people I was witnessing dying were members of the enemy, and they were all fishermen and farmers, and half of them were children, and they were napalmed to death. And the official story was we were just killing enemy VC. I mean, I learned, that's when I started realizing that the government says whatever it wants to promote its ideology, but the reality is something very different. And until there's some process by which we can establish the proof of innocence or guilt, after 11 years, why have they not brought charges? And furthermore, the United States has no moral or legal authority to go to other countries and kidnap people. That's just a gross violation of
That was Portland peace activist Brian Wilson. The Daily Vigil in Portland is from 4 to 6 p.m. outside of City Hall. More information can be found on the website closeguantanamo.net.
A new study finds that heroin use among Washington youth has increased over the past decade. The report comes from the University of Washington's Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute. It found that in most Washington counties, overdose deaths more than doubled between 2000 and 2011. The largest increases in heroin abuse occurred outside of metropolitan areas where there are less drug treatment programs. According to the report's author, Caleb Banta-Green, the higher rates can be attributed to cheaper and easier to find heroin.
The parents of 22-year-old Nicholas Lookabill, an Iraq War veteran who was killed during a September 2010 encounter with Vancouver police, filed a wrongful death lawsuit yesterday in federal court. The suit states that Lookabill attempted to cooperate with police before they shot him. According to the Columbian, the parents seek $11.5 million. The lawsuit also charges that officers knew Lookabill suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, but failed to assess the situation and were not properly trained to deal with a war veteran suffering from mental illness. Vancouver police say Lookabill was armed with a handgun and threatened officers at about 3:30 a.m. near downtown. Sergeant John Schultz and officers Frank Gomez and Gerardo Gutierrez fired the shots that killed Lookabill and were put on administrative leave. Lookabill served overseas for 1 year, and friends say he was nervous about being redeployed.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this newscast, followed by Right to Survive at 6. Confronting the housing crisis and organizing housing activists to address systemic inequalities. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. And tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy, with a 50% chance of showers and a high temperature of 64 degrees Fahrenheit.